WBEZ's Nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
Nothing is certain except death and taxes. But it can be a lot easier to file your taxes than it can be to even get the conversation in your family started around death and end-of-life care. But our next guest says knowing how to do that can change everything. I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. After spending decades at the bedsides of more than 1,000 dying patients as a hospice nurse, Suzanne O'Brien is on a mission to remind us that death is not a medical experience, but rather a human one. And O'Brien says planning ahead makes the transition as smooth as possible, not just for them, but for you and everyone involved. She's written about it in a new book called The Good Death, A Guide for Supporting Your Loved One Through the End of Life. And Suzanne O'Brien joined us to talk about her book and much more. She began with telling us why she thinks so many people fear death and how she believes this affects the dying process. Here's Suzanne.
That's such a great question. And it's really, I had to go down and do my research right away when I started to get into this field because the fear was paralyzing. The fear was blocking people from making good choices, sound choices, and the fear was preventing us from having any education or planning around this space. And so it really is only within the last 100 to 120 years that we've removed everything we know about the natural experience that end of life is from our awareness. We've made great medical advances, and in one sense, that's fantastic. But at the same time, we've removed seeing people age, having the end of life where 100 years ago, the average age of life was 47. Today, it's 80, 81, and we just don't see that process. And somehow, this fear element got developed around end of life and death in a very, very serious way, as you know.
How does fear make things more difficult?
When fear, whatever the situation is, when fear is present, we don't make good choices. And so when someone, this is a really hard one because we know no matter how much we are prepared for it or think about it, saying goodbye to someone we love in this physical world is a hard thing, regardless. And so when it does show up, and we know 100% of the time it will, when we're not prepared, we haven't thought about it ahead of time, that fear literally hijacks the situation and makes us really reach and do things that we wouldn't normally do if we had time to just think about what quality of life is and what ask our loved ones what they want and make sure that those are part of the plan for that end of life section.
Mm-hmm. And there's a balancing act involved, right? When you're dealing with that impending loss of someone, because on one hand, you want to do whatever you can to ease their suffering. You're watching them dwindle and you want to do whatever you can to make them comfortable. But you also need to ease your own pain and suffering, and maybe even the pain and suffering of loved ones around you. How do you strike that balance?
Absolutely. And I think that having this conversation, and I thank you so much for doing this segment, because having this conversation now, when we're not faced with it, allows me to say, Mom, I want to be able to show up for you in the fullest way possible. I need to know what you want. What does that look like so that I can provide that for you? And so when we're not faced at the bedside of the ICU, when I can ask her and we can talk about it, it's a couple of wins across the board. Number one, it allows me to know what I can do. It's a roadmap. I have a guide now of how to support her. Mm-hmm. The second thing that it does, which is really important, it really allows me, whether consciously or subconsciously or both, to understand that this time that I have is such a gift with my loved ones, with myself. And so I literally use my time in a very different level of gratitude and awareness that I might not have if I am under the, assumption that it goes on forever. Mm-hmm. So asking people, and then also individually for me to choose what quality of life is for me, to make sure that I let my families and my medical practitioner know that, so they have a roadmap on how to support me when that difficult time comes.
Yeah. So let's illustrate that a little bit in this mm-hmm. quality of life conversation. You yeah. write, Suzanne, about finding peace of mind in five key areas. So first you write about the physical good death. Then you go on to the mental good death, the emotional, the financial, mm-hmm. and the spiritual. So in physical, you talk about two men, Rick and Leo, and mm-hmm. you sort of describe how their final weeks and months were very different. Briefly yeah. recap yeah. that for us.
I would love to, because this was such a learning experience for me, just watching both of these men. And they were both 80 years old. They were both diagnosed with lung cancer within a month of each other. One lived in New York, one lived in Boston. They both chose very different paths to go down. The one in Boston went into aggressive treatment, chemotherapy, radiation right away. And the one in New York, he said to himself, he said, you know, I've lived a good life. I think I'm just going to go home. I'm going to go on hospice and I'm going to live out my days as many as I have. Mm-hmm. And it was very interesting because both of these men lived a year, and the one who went home on hospice lived a month longer. But here's the thing about that year. The quality of life that they both had was very, very different. The man, we understand that, you know, choosing to have treatment and chemotherapy, it can be a hard course to endure. And so he was sick a lot of the time, and he, you know, was weak a lot of the time and back in the hospital. And I remember the family said that when he was on hospice, they had about 5 days on hospice care to his end of life. It was very scrambled and very quick. Mm. And the other gentleman was gardening. He was telling jokes up until his last week. And he lived, and it's ironic, he lived a month longer than the other person. And I think that, if I may, quality of life should be all of our benchmarks. And when we get our information, there is no judgment in what somebody chooses. But here's what I'm finding is missing in the world: making subjective, informed decisions for yourself on when you want to go down and try different treatments, and getting all your information allows you to make that educated choice for yourself. Mm-hmm. And so quality of life and knowing when it's not there anymore and not able to be regained, because that does become a point. Maybe again, I want to think to myself, I just like to be home with tight symptom management, with my pets, with my family, and have the highest quality every single day that I can have.
Right. In the mental and emotional sections, of course, you talk about altering the way that we think about death in the first place, and just sort of coming to peace with the idea of it, which I think is really key as well, mm-hmm. Suzanne, because, and I'm speaking from experience, people just don't want to talk about it. I don't talk directly to my parents who are in their mm-hmm. 70s about mm-hmm. next steps. I know that they've taken care of things, at least I think. Right. In one case, I think she has. I know my dad has. But have we sat down and like had the in-depth conversation about what I'm supposed to do in the event of? No. Do I feel compelled to have that conversation tomorrow, this weekend? Not really. But after reading your book, mm-hmm. I'm understanding why that's so important.
It's so important for multiple reasons. First of all, it allows you an opportunity to ask them questions, clarifying questions on what they're asking and how you can support them. But what it also does is allows us again to go there. Oh, one day this journey will come to an end. And it literally allows you to make some, you know, like pathways within your brain that when you get there, and this is the biggest issue I feel like that's happening right now, is that when death shows up, and 100% of the time it will, no matter how much we push it away for how long, it's usually a shock mm-hmm. for not just the person, but for the family. And everything falls apart then. Like, and you know, we're ending up putting Band-Aids on something very late. If you have a roadmap to helping your parents and you know where things are, as hard as that time, and it will be hard, it will be that much healthier. And I want to use that word intentionally, because we know that this is going to be difficult no matter what, but can we have a healthy end of life? Can it be a positive? Can I support my mom in where she wants to be? How comfortable with, again, all the choices that we do have to make. And then also, what about for after her end of life, her life celebration, honoring her?
Right.
Can I uphold all of that? And that feels really good. That, by the way, will dramatically impact the grief and bereavement that all of the loved ones and family members go through, whether it's going to be traumatic mm-hmm. or it's going to be, again, a healthy grief and bereavement period.
The financial good death, that is, well, that's another tough one there, Suzanne, because yep. I've seen situations where loved ones die without a will.
All across the board. And for your listeners, I really want them to know this, is that when we do hear the word will, we might think of, and lawyers might think of, this very big lift, right? Very expensive big lift. I want you to know that it doesn't have to be. I think that that story of Aretha Franklin, who wrote her will on a napkin and it was found in her couch mm-hmm. and it was deemed and it was upheld. So we don't want you to do that, but we want you to take measures because, again, one of the greatest gifts you can leave your family is having your items in order. And there are very simple ways that are written in that book that you can do that. You can do something called a pour-over will, and you can do, wills online that you can get. I think that it's our responsibility, each and every one of us, to choose again where we would want to be at the end of life and how that looks or what we'd want or not want. And then also making sure I have my items in order so that it's not left for my family. They've said it takes an average of 16 months to settle an estate. And when I do not do my due diligence, mm-hmm. it makes it that much more complicated and expensive for my family members. I don't want that for them.
Tell us a bit more about your background, Suzanne. Were you always working in hospice care? And the term death doula, that's an interesting one. What does that entail?
Yes. Okay. Thank you for that. So I became a registered nurse and I was working in the mainstream medical system in the hospital. And I remember feeling really unfulfilled. You know, I was giving out medications. I was doing documentation. I had very little time with patients. And I remember just hearing this voice inside to say, go to hospice. And at the time I didn't know why, because I had no end of life experience, but something lit up, something felt really aligned with that. So I followed that. And I knew the very first day that I went out to see hospice patients, I was in the exact place I was supposed to be in my life. So it was just, it was purpose. And then when I was working in hospice care, which is our end of life care provider, a beautiful model of care, but because of the reimbursement structure, the way that things operate now, it's very fragmented and there's lots of gaps in that model and system. The end of lives for most families weren't going as well as they could go. And so I started analyzing what happened here. And it's really that fear. Mm-hmm. It's the removal of end of life. And I want to say this to you, that I ask all of us that are listening to this, just ask yourself for a minute, if you have a fear of end of life, try and identify what that fear is, because most of us can't put a actual reason for it. We just know that we've been kind of told, you know, we're fighting battles with cancer, or, you know, we've got to fight this disease process. And maybe this just kind of got into a space where we've removed it so far that a fear has developed around it that shouldn't be there. And I say this because I started noticing right away at the end of life that people at the end of life started saying many of the same things that they were experiencing.
Like what?
That they would say things like, there's no judgment, and that we're all connected, and that everything that happened to them, because there's an organic thing that happens at our end of life that is a life review, and we want to know that our life had meaning, and we want to know that we contributed. And they start to do these organically, and then when they have what I call that spiritual awakening or awareness that comes when they were saying the same things, like there's no judgment, that all of those things happened for them, not to them. It was a change in perception that allowed them to let go of things that they were carrying around with them, a way to have clarity and healing. They talk about unconditional love, and they also talk about time being the greatest commodity we have, and wanting to make sure that those of us left behind know that how we choose to spend our time and who we choose to spend it with is the most important decision that we'll make.
Yeah.
Because it's those elements that allow us, when our day gets to that space that this journey will change, to be able to say, okay, because if we use the time well, then that's what should happen. And right now they say that death is the number one fear in the world. And I have to tell you, it wasn't the fear of the death for my patients. And I've been honored to be with over 1,000 people. It was really the regret that their time was up and that they didn't live.
Mm-hmm. Caregiver burnout. That's something
yes.
that you write about. I'm really glad you included that, right? You know,
thank you.
Depression, anxiety, anger, resentment, grief, all normal, you say, mm-hmm. but those mm-hmm. feelings can become debilitating. So how do you avoid that?
I think we need to come up with this conversation across the board. We need to bring back death as the natural, sacred experience it was meant to be and get the education out there, because here's what's happening. There's a caregiver caring for their loved one, and I will often say this, end-of-life care cannot and should not be done by one person, yet it's done all the time like that. I think because of this fear, and we just don't want to necessarily get involved because, oh, it's, you know, it's an end-of-life, that's heavy. If she needs help, she'll ask, and that's really not the case. You find caregivers just drowning in this. And so in that book is what's called a support system scheduler. And it gives you literally a week by week outline of what people can do to offer some respite care. And I think for all of us, just from an ethical standpoint, if you know a family member, if you know somebody that is in that position, offer them help. What can I do? And it can be as easy as sending meals to the house. It can be as easy as talking on the phone, an hour of respite care. And I think that, again, you know, we have to get back to a communal humanity that we've really forgotten about. And I will often say that, yes, we are waiting for big things to be changed with laws, and that takes time. And some of that is somewhat out of our control at times.
Yeah.
We all have the control every single day to choose to show up in kindness and compassion and presence. And that can start immediately. And think about that. If we all knew who I could just extend some compassion to and kindness and say, hey, what can I do for you today? Can change everything for them.
Yeah.
So that schedule's there. And again, I just want to get this conversation going, because people will say, well, she didn't ask for help. She probably doesn't even know the first thing about what to ask for, because she's overwhelmed. In fact, if I may, AARP did a study and they said that 48 million caregivers presently in the United States, 70% of them say they are overwhelmed and don't know what to do.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah,
and I get it,
because I work with them all the time. So the two main regrets for my caregiver group, what they said is that they wish they had taken better care of themselves while they were in the situation, and they wish that they had asked for help.
Toward the end of the book, you say, when we hold space for someone at the end of life and are privileged to witness a good death, you say it bestows life-changing wisdom on us. Say more, Suzanne.
Yeah, the minute that I started working with those at the end of life, my life completely changed. And it was like, I look at life now with a different lens on. And that lens is, I have to go to the gym today. Now it's, I get to go to the gym today. Everything, and really it taught me that live each day like one little lifetime, because you just don't know how many days you have and you don't want to miss it. So I said, okay, what's important to me in that day? Being present. And I really want to, you know, highlight that, because I think we're living in such a stressed world.
Yes.
Where we have so much stimulation on us. The task list is ever, ever flowing. And so we jump out of bed, we get the coffee, we start doing it. And are we human doings or human beings? And we forgot about the being part. Slowing down, connecting to gratitude, connecting to nature, checking in with myself, giving that smile to the stranger on the street, because we're all connected. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, just what is the gift that I came in to give? And I really want to emphasize this, because at the end of life for my patients, it wasn't the fear of the death being imminent. It was the fear that they didn't share their gift. They didn't live. And
right.
That was a huge regret. And so when they bestow that wisdom on us, have we, and I want to ask you this, have we possibly removed the greatest teacher about how to actually live with non-judgment, with compassion, with presence and time being our greatest commodity from our world today? And I'm going to say, absolutely. Mm-hmm. We see the chaos, you know, we see that. And so it's interesting that we've removed the teacher, and it's time to bring that back for multiple reasons. And
absolutely.
Here's the thing I want to, I just want to share that end of life can go really, really well.
Yes.
With right education, kindness, and support. And everyone is entitled to have that.
And a great book to help guide you.
Yeah.
So the overall message here, we're still here, we're living,
yes.
But we got to make the most of it, and we have to plan.
Yes.
Plan. Suzanne O'Brien is author of the new book, The Good Death, A Guide for Supporting Your Loved One Through the End of Life. It's in stores now, wherever books are sold. Thank you, Suzanne.
Thank you so much.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by me, Sasha Ann Simons. It was edited by Meha Ahmed and mixed by Ari Mejia. Reset brings you curious conversations that we hope inspire you and bring insight to your daily life. To learn more, hit subscribe or find us at wbez.org/reset. Thanks for listening. We'll meet again later today.
My name is Liz, and as a teacher, I think that WBEZ provides endless sources that I can bring back to my students where they can also engage in a deeper understanding. I teach government, I teach U.S. history, and I have used sources from WBEZ in order to help enrich the understanding of my students.